Virus Ground Zero by Ed Regis. Copyright 1996 by Ed Regis. This recording of the full-length reading of Virus Ground Zero was published by arrangement with the Jean V. Nagar Literary Agency and was produced in 1999 by Books on Tape, Incorporated, which holds the copyright thereto. Neither this recording nor any part thereof may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authority from Books on Tape, Incorporated. This book is read by Rob McQuay. Prologue. A Mother and Daughter. It was quiet in there. It was so very quiet that she heard nothing at all for long stretches of time, nothing but the breathing sounds of her mother, her very own mother, who was lying in bed with her, lying in the same hospital bed in which Loki Mbele now lay. Loki Mbele was 20 years old. Her mother was 42, and they were the only two living souls in the small, quiet room. It had been the measles ward. Children once lay in those beds, but there were no longer any children here. In fact, only one other person was in the measles ward, a patient in the bed across the aisle. An IV bottle hung from a hook above the patient's head, and a tube ran down from the bottle to a needle stuck in his arm. An intravenous solution had been dripping into his arm, but now the IV bottle was empty and dry. He had lain there like that, in his own dried blood and bodily effusions, his bloodshot eyes staring up at the ceiling, for the last couple of days. The patient was dead. In the afternoon, some men came into the room from the outside. They looked around but said nothing, and they did not touch the patients. Then they were gone. Loki Mbele's mother was breathing very fast now, making short, quick, gulping noises, gasping for air, trying to force a single good breath into her lungs. Later that night, her mother, still lying next to her in the same bed, stopped breathing. The next day, the men came again. They wore face masks and surgical caps and ankle-length gowns, and they lifted Loki Mbele up off the bed, placed her on a moving cart, and wheeled the cart out of the measles ward. They wheeled her out into the open air, across the grass courtyard, and onto a covered walkway. A distance from the covered walkway on the outside face of a concrete wall, a sign said, République du Zaïre, Région de Bandundu, Ville de Kikwit, Hôpital Général. Kikwit General Hospital had 326 beds distributed out in 10 separate buildings called pavilions. The pavilions had no electricity, no running water, and no proper sanitation. There was no bathroom and no kitchen, and the hospital provided no meals to its patients. The moving cart squeaked as it went. Some goats were lying down on the covered walkway, and they got up as the cart moved past. The men wheeled Loki Mbele into Pavilion 3. Pavilion 3 contained a long, open ward room with 16 beds, 8 on either side of a center aisle. The hospital attendants wheeled Loki Mbele down the center aisle, lifted her up off the cart, and placed her in one of the empty beds. She lay on her back on a thin mattress without sheets, on a metal bed frame whose faded white paint had chipped off and worn away over years of use. A rumpled, bright-colored blanket half covered her body. Other patients were in the wardroom, on other beds, and on the floor, and the whole room smelled of bleach. As she lay there now, she herself started to gulp for air in small, quick gasps. Her eyes opened wide, in an expression of fright, as if she were about to scream. Then she vomited onto the mattress and the floor. She lay there like that for the rest of the day. Through an open window above her head, she could see the lower surface of the overhanging roof. The sun was setting behind the trees, shining in through the open doorway at the far end of the room, the light slanting in with an orange tint. Now it was evening, almost night. A kerosene lantern sat on a table, but it had not been lit, and so it was quite dark in the pavilion. The beds, the patients, and the blue walls were fading from view, becoming soft and imprecise. Then Loki Mbele could hear voices from the outside, the sounds of people talking, and then the voices were coming closer, a couple of people. She could hear footsteps, the squish of rubber boots on wet concrete, and she could see flashlight beams, spots of light bobbing up and down on the walls and along the floor. Then two figures were inside the pavilion. They moved among the beds, stopping for a moment at the different patients. One of the figures had a miner's lamp strapped to his head, and it lit up his gloved hands as he washed a patient's skin with a cloth. After a while, one of the figures came toward Loki Mbele. "How do you feel?" he asked in French. Loki and Belly gasped for air. He felt her pulse. Finally, she said,
"Water, please. Juice."
A plastic water bottle sat on the table across the room. The figure walked to it, poured out some water into a cup, and brought it to Loki and Belle. She did not extend her hand for the cup, so he reached down and supported her head, and she took a few sips. Then the figure moved away, the flashlight glare now out of her eyes. She saw that both of the men were leaving, moving back out of the pavilion. She saw the spots of light bobbing to and fro around the room. They were the last things she saw. Next morning, her body was sprayed with bleach, placed in a white plastic bag, and sprayed again. Then it was put on a gurney and wheeled to the morgue. The morgue was some distance from Pavilion 3, down the covered walkway and back out across the grass. The small concrete building had a single door, a door that was always open now, because there'd been so many deaths at Kikwit General Hospital. A line of other bleach-sprayed bodies covered the floor of the morgue, and the attendants placed the body of Loki and Belle next to them. It was not the ideal place for any sort of post-mortem procedure, much less for a formal autopsy. There were no stainless steel examination tables here, no floodlights, no automated scales with digital readouts giving you the precise weight of each of the body's various organs as you place them in the hopper. There was just a concrete floor, oozing and slippery with blood, bodily secretions, and sprayed bleach. But a tissue sample would prove beyond doubt what it was that Loki and Belle had died from. And so one of the figures from the night before, masked and gowned, wearing a cap, goggles, and a clean white surgical apron, now crouched over the body bag. He opened up the body bag. He pushed back a layer of clothing, revealing Loki and Belle's dark skin. He swabbed the skin with alcohol, and then carefully, deliberately, making sure that the sharp edge of the knife pointed away from himself at all times, he made an incision into the abdomen, just above the navel. He pulled back the skin flaps, made another incision, and found the liver. He shoved a biopsy needle into the liver, twisted it, and pulled it out again. He turned and dropped the sample into a plastic vial, which he placed into a box. He closed the body bag. He picked up his scalpel and sample box, stood up, and took a last look around. Then he got out of there. Chapter 1. The Call. Word of the Kikwit outbreak reached the Centers for Disease Control at 4:20 in the afternoon of Saturday, May 6, 1995. Unfortunately, on Saturdays, the CDC was closed. So instead of going into the main switchboard, the call came into the reception desk in the lobby of the administration building, where it was answered by Diane Hairston Nash, a security guard who worked there nights and weekends. The caller was not, as might be expected, a harried doctor at the Kikwit Hospital. Nor was it a Zairean public health official. The caller was one Julia Weeks, an American physician at a private non-profit clinic in Zaire, who at that moment was speaking into her personal cellular telephone while sitting on a bench overlooking the tennis courts at the British Embassy in Kinshasa. "I think we've got an outbreak of Ebola virus down here," she said over the phone. "I'd like to talk to somebody about it." She'd learned about the epidemic just that very morning. She'd been at work at the Zaire American Clinic, of which she was the medical director, when a friend of hers, Larry Streshley, who did public health work for the Presbyterian Mission in Kinshasa, stopped in for a piece of advice. He'd been in radio contact with a hospital in the interior of the country, in Kikwit, where there was this huge outbreak of red diarrhea, also known as Shigella. "He was getting a bunch of stuff together to send on a plane that was to go from Kinshasa to Kikwit," Julia Weeks recalled later. "He was getting together drugs to deal with it, and we were discussing which antibiotics would be most appropriate, and which were available, and what sort of equipment they would need, in terms of gloves and gowns, to help provide some barrier care." This in itself was not unusual. Shigella was common enough all throughout Africa, so she made a few suggestions and Larry Streshley left. That night, she attended a cocktail party at the British Embassy. Many of the guests were talking about the new outbreak, but now a rumor was going around that it was not in fact Shigella, but rather Ebola, a viral hemorrhagic fever, with a fatality rate of up to 90%. Some of the guests came up to Julia Weeks and asked her about it.
"As far as I've heard from the symptoms that were presented to me this morning, it wouldn't be Ebola," she told them.
But then Gerald Scott, the American DCM, the deputy chief of mission, introduced her to Dan Pater, an official of the Catholic Church of Zaire, who was also at the party.
Pater had just talked with some nuns who'd act.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?